Vayomer Adonai el Moshe bo el paro, ki ani hichbadti es libo, v'eslev avodav leman. Shisi ososai ele bikirbo. Hashem said to Moshe, come to Paro, for I have made his heart and the heart of his servants stubborn, so that I can put these signs of mine in his midst.
OU Israel presents...
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Bo. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the sixth day of Shavat, 5777, corresponding this year to February 2nd, which we all know fondly as Groundhog's Day. And I think that's about all I'll say about that, unless I have time, which I'm not sure I will. In any event, that's the story. And we will begin with Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tihyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai miya amod, ki imacha hasalicha lama'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi velidvaro hochalti. Nafshi la Adonai mi shomerim la boker, shomerim la boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omedim ebein bayam, uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem, v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, umi'afela la'ora, umi'shibud l'gu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. At the opening of the show, not going to make it into a contest or anything, at the opening of the show, you heard the theme from the movie Exodus, and since the Exodus, capital T and capital E, occurs in Parshat Bo, I usually play the theme from Exodus. This one was by Henry Mancini, and it hit me that the story of the movie Exodus is not related to Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt, but based on what I've been saying at least these last 2 weeks, it has a very, very strong message. Exodus, we think in terms of coming out from Egypt. But if you remember what I reminded you of with the prophecy by God to Moshe at the burning bush, there was an inseparable, immediate purpose of coming out of Egypt. God says to Moshe, I will go down there, meaning Egypt, to save the people from the hand of the Egyptians in order to bring them up to a good and expansive land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the land of the Canaan, etc., etc. There is a purpose to the Exodus, which is part of the Exodus. The ship, illegal immigrant ship, during British mandatory time, was named Exodus because Jews were being taken out of post-war, post-Holocaust Europe, but they were being brought to the land of Israel. And that, I believe, whether the dictionary will say so or not, becomes an important, integral part of the meaning of the word Exodus. It's not, you're out, now figure out what you're going to do, or here are your choices. You're out in order to go to Eretz Yisrael. And that holds true of the Exodus, Yitziat Mitzrayim, and it holds true of the ship, the Exodus, as in the movie. Okay, so that's one thing. Second, I wanted to focus on the first verse in Bo, which I read earlier and translated based on the Art Scroll Stone edition of the Chumash. And it mentions right in that verse that God is sending Moshe to Pharaoh because God has hardened his heart. Now, this is a question that came up in last week's Sedra. It really came up in Shemot as well, when God tells Moshe up front, you're going to ask for the people to leave, and Paro's going to say no. And that will highlight the whole downfall through the plagues and on to the actual leaving of Egypt. Question is based on the noticeable change in grammar from Paro hardened his own heart, Paro remained stubborn, as opposed to God's statement that we have here, Ki ani hichbadti et libo ve'et lev avadav. I have hardened his heart and that of his advisors and servants. So the question is, how do we understand that? Now, we've done this recently. Do it again briefly. There are two very interesting, different, almost diametrically opposed explanations to what's going on with God hardening Pharaoh's heart. One answers the question of what happens to Paro's free will. The answer, on the one hand, is God took it away. Human beings have free will. They usually lose their free will at death, or even earlier than that, during an incapacitating kind of illness, where you can't really say they still have free will. And in this case of Paro, he lost his free will, again, according to this one view, because God had an agenda. He said, Paro repeatedly hardened his own heart. That's it. I'm not going to give him the option anymore of letting the people go. But I have an agenda, says God, and that includes the full range of the 10 plagues and the events of the night before the Exodus. And that needs to be carried out mostly, not just to punish Egypt and to punish Paro, but more so to display and demonstrate to the people of Israel and actually to all nations in the world who will hear the story of the Exodus, who God is. So, put simply, what happened to his free will? He lost it. And that's not considered a contradiction, because there are natural circumstances where a person loses his free will. And this is an example of one that was forced, so to speak, by God. Can he be held accountable for how he behaves, knowing that God took away his free will? If you follow this opinion, then the answer is no, he's not held accountable and not punished for what he does when he has no choice. He's only punished, well, for when he does have a choice, which was the whole beginning of the process. There's another school of thought, as I said, diametrically opposed to this, which says, hardening his heart under the severity of plague after plague is the only way to allow him to retain his free will. If he were to buckle under the pressure of the plagues and say, okay, go, get lost, that would not be a free will decision. That would be a decision that is forced by the circumstances of the severity of the Makot. The only way to maintain his free will and be able to hold him accountable is to make him more and more stubborn as he goes along. Then, and only then, can he exercise his free will. Two totally different ways of looking at it, and I believe both have merit. How could that be? You're right also. This is part of the concept of Shivim Panim LaTorah. There are 70 aspects or faces to the Torah, and they don't negate each other, they complement each other. It's another way of looking at things, and here I think both have merit. Next, up till now, in last week's Sedra, Va'era, we had the first seven plagues. Dum, blood, Tzvardea, frogs, Kinim, lice, Arov, either wild animals, which is one opinion, or swarms of insects, which is another opinion. Dever was a disease that struck the cattle. Shchin, boils, which was in essence a disease that came further home by striking the people. And then hail, barad. That was an unusually severe plague, and that's how Va'era ended. In Parshat Bo, we have the last three makot, Arbe, locust, Choshech, a debilitating darkness, and then the final plague, which was always the one presented up front. Very first words to Paro, if you don't let the people out, God will kill your firstborn. And then there was the Makot, and as if Egypt kept saying, or Pharaoh kept saying, don't believe you, don't believe you, don't believe you. Sure, you're turning the water into blood and you're bringing frogs, but where's your threat to kill the firstborns? There it is, number 10. And that was the one that broke Paro, and he let the people go. So that's the quick overview in Parshat Bo. Now let's take a look specifically in the direction of mitzvot, commandments. 613 mitzvot in the Torah, 54 weekly portions, averages around 11-something mitzvot per seder. The last 18 weekly Torah readings, and that means an extra week 19, because there was Chol HaMoed Sukkot, which we didn't have a regular reading. So the last 18/19 weeks, we have read 18 weekly portions. That's more than a third, for a total of 5 mitzvot. The other, how many left? 54 altogether. Sorry, minus 18 is 38. The other 38 sedras. What am I talking about? Hi, math teacher that I am, or was. We're talking about 54 minus 18. Yes, 36. The other 36 sedras contain 608 mitzvot. There are 17 sedras that don't have any. And really, the lion's share of mitzvot come from only six sedras. In any event, Bo puts us back on the map, mitzvah-wise. It has 20 mitzvot. Most involve Pesach. Some involve offshoots of the commemoration of Pesach into other mitzvot not related to the holiday, but certainly related to the concept of the firstborn or the concept of freedom from Egypt. Among those 20, we have a starting point. The starting point is chapter 12 in the book of Shemot, and it is, and God spoke to Moshe and to Aharon in the land of Egypt, saying to them, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim. This month, namely Nisan, shall be the first of your months. Rishon Hu Lachem L'Chodshei Hashana. It is the first of the months of the year. Now, that, we are taught, is a mitzvah. According to Rambam, it's the mitzvah to make a Jewish calendar. According to Ramban, it applies to the aspect of the calendar by which months are declared based on the cycle of the moon's phases. And a separate mitzvah, according to Ramban, Nachmanides. Rambam doesn't agree. He says it's all one mitzvah to make a calendar, but the Ramban counts as a separate mitzvah, the mitzvah to periodically add an extra month to the year so that Korban Pesach, Pesach in general, will be in the springtime and Sukkot will be in the fall. The significance of Pesach in the springtime can't be overemphasized. It has to do with the renewal of life after a period of dormancy and almost death. This happens in nature every year, Nisan time, and it happened to the Jewish people over their winter darkness of Egyptian servitude, emerging into the spring of redemption. Anyone who knows me from Torah Tibbetz, from Torah Tibbetz Audio, from teaching, knows that one of my favorite topics is the Jewish calendar, and knows that I cannot give just a simple passing comment about the mitzvah of HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, so I need to talk it up a little. Well known that the very, very first Rashi in all of Torah in Bereshit suggested or asked the question, how come the Torah started at creation, assuming that the Torah is a guidebook for Jewish life? It should have started, says Rashi, with the very first mitzvah commanded to the people of Israel, which is set up your calendar. But Rashi continues and gives the reason for the Exodus, the creation account and the flood and the stories of the patriarchs and matriarchs and the tribes. But that does not change or does not address the specialness of HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, the setting up of the calendar, as the first mitzvah commanded to the people of Israel. Okay, it's not in the beginning of the Torah, but it is in the beginning, really, of the mitzvah content of the Torah. So, what's to it? First, on the negative side, not negative for us, well, yes, on the, I don't know how to say it anymore, the fact that the Hanukkah story defines or presents to us the focus of the Greek Syrians or the Syrian Greeks to tear us away from our Judaism. Their main targets were Shabbat, Brit Milah, and Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctification of the month. Shabbat is a sort of a personal thing that we all do, and Brit Milah is an individual thing. They do have national significance, but in essence they're performed by each individual Jew. Kiddush HaChodesh is a communal process done by the Sanhedrin, as the command was originally issued to Moshe and to Aaron in the land of Egypt, and they were the leaders of the community. So too, in all generations, the leaders of the community, namely the Sanhedrin, is in charge of the process of Kiddush HaChodesh. Now let me quickly outline past and future and differentiate it from present. Past, when we had a Sanhedrin. Future, when we will again have a Sanhedrin. Present, when we are in between Sanhedrins. It's a long period, but it's temporary. And there are two calendar systems in operation. One that applies when we have a Sanhedrin. Again, I emphasize past and future. And the other one, we don't have a Sanhedrin, which I call the present. When we have a Sanhedrin, the process starts with a committee of Sanhedrin members who must know and be expert in astronomy, be able to calculate the timings of the heavenly bodies, and be able to determine exactly when and where the first visibility of the lunar crescent will be. When and where. Then, armed with this knowledge of the cycle, they will interview witnesses who are coming to testify that they might have seen the first visibility of the lunar crescent. And the Sanhedrin members who interview these witnesses will be able to determine whether they actually saw the new moon or not, based on their questions, based on their pre-existing knowledge. Banish the thought, perish the thought, that in the olden times, witnesses had to come to testify because people didn't know when the moon would first be visible. Ain't so. They knew well, maybe better than we do today. The timing is extremely accurate based on modern timing and calculation as well. And the system was very human. And that means a little bit on the inefficient side. The Sanhedrin would wait for witnesses if, on the night following the 29th of a month, they calculated that the moon could be visible. Witnesses would either come or they wouldn't. And they would come from Jerusalem, and they would come from near and far, because the weather conditions and the sighting conditions are not always going to be the same. And sometimes they come in great numbers, and sometimes they are very few. But the primary method of sanctification of a new moon starts with eyewitness testimony that the Sanhedrin can verify based on their knowledge. So you might ask, and it's a very reasonable question, if the Sanhedrin is able to calculate and to know in advance when the moon will be visible, what do we need people to say, "I saw the moon"? The Sanhedrin could answer, "Duh, we know that you saw the moon because we calculated that it was visible." Or, "No, you didn't see the moon because we calculated that it wasn't visible." And they had very accurate calculations. The answer is that God wants us to be full, let's call ourselves junior partners with Him in the process of creating the calendar, also, you could look at it as being partners with him in the sanctification of time. We have a prior example of God's sanctifying of time by himself. He created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, and therefore he sanctified the seventh day. Shabbat is an act of sanctification of time by God, and his command to us as to how to behave on Shabbat. But it's his act of sanctification. When it comes to the calendar, to Rosh Chodesh, and the holidays included, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Pesach, Shavuot, on a Torah level, Purim, Chanukah, etc., on a rabbinic level, that includes, in its ideal state, past and future, the active participation on the part of the Jews in order to then allow their leader to proclaim the day as holy. It's as if you can ask God, when's Pesach? And he says, I don't know yet. Check with people. Check with the Jewish people. This is how he wants it. I gave a brief idea that it's not an efficient system, because if you have a cloudy night and you're not able to see the moon, it's still there. It's still behind the clouds, but you can't see it. If you can't see it, you can't testify to it. If you can't testify to it, then you no longer have the ideal situation whereby the day can be proclaimed as Rosh Chodesh based on eyewitness testimony. Other systems kick in, but they are no longer the ideal. Let's leave it at that. During the time that we are without a Sanhedrin, a prior Sanhedrin organized a formula by which we are capable of generating our calendar each year. It does not require looking at the moon. It does not require astronomical knowledge. It requires just computational skills. You have to know how to add and or use a calculator or a computer. But we are no longer, at this moment, until the restoration of the Sanhedrin, we are no longer active partners with God in the process of setting up the Jewish calendar. We are observers. And as efficient as our calendar is, the fact that you can buy a calendar for the year in advance, which you cannot do in the past and future system, the fact that there is no question marks about the different dates in the calendar, as there are when you have eyewitness testimony, it is more efficient but less participatory on our point, on our side. And the ideal is to be partners with God. So which is better? A system that you can predict in advance, calculate in advance, no room for human error, or a flawed system by which there can be human error, not just on witnesses testifying and not just on weather not being conducive to sighting of the first visibility of the lunar crescent, but even a Sanhedrin could make a mistake and proclaim the wrong day, Rosh Chodesh. It's valid, it sticks, and God, so to speak, changes his calendar if the Beit Din, the Sanhedrin, proclaims Rosh Chodesh in the right way or not the right way. That becomes the right day. Which is better? No question that the less efficient human involvement is what God wants, and that makes it a better system. Now, in the past, in addition to the process of proclaiming Rosh Chodesh, came the task of notifying Jewish communities all over Israel when Rosh Chodesh was proclaimed. That took time, and that will be different with the next Sanhedrin. The process of eyewitness testimony to the first visibility of the lunar crescent will not change. What will change is the television, radio, internet, email, etc., streaming of the pronouncement of the head of the Sanhedrin that a certain day is Rosh Chodesh, and instantly Jews all over the world will be notified, and it won't take more than a couple of seconds or minutes at least from when it was actually done, as opposed to the old times when you needed at a certain period, they used bonfires, waved from mountaintop to mountaintop, and that proved to be problematic because of those who wanted to falsify the timing of Rosh Chodesh. And then there were bonded messengers that were sent out of out of Yerushalayim to give notice to the communities when Rosh Chodesh was. And it took time. It could take up to 2 weeks. And that's a whole other story. So in the future, the process till the Nasi pronounces the day as holy will be the same or very similar. And yet, after that, rapid fire, thanks to the internet and, as I said, probably live TV coverage, Jews anywhere they are will know immediately when Rosh Chodesh is. The only time that will still be problematic in those days of the future is Rosh Hashanah. Because Rosh Hashanah, you need to begin the day as a Yom Tov, as Holy Day, before the day begins. In the evening, you have the the lighting of Yom Tov candles, and you have the prayers at the beginning of Yom Tov, and all of these need to presuppose that the day might turn out to be the first of Tishrei, but maybe not, in which case there's a second day. So I think 2 days of Rosh Hashanah are going to be around for a long time, and the notwithstanding the instant notification, as I said, Rosh Hashanah, first day of Tishrei, there's no time. Not there's only a little time, there's no time. Changing gears here, let me point out another phenomenon which is very obvious in Parshat Bo. We have the story of the night of the Exodus together with mitzvot that apply to the night of the Exodus. For example, Korban Pesach was to be brought on the 14th of Nisan in the afternoon. That was to be done the very first time when the Jews were still in Egypt, and that was to be done for Korban Pesach in perpetuity, forever. How about smearing the blood of the Korban Pesach onto the doorposts and lintel of one's home? No, only Pesach Mitzrayim, the very first Pesach still in Egypt, and not to be perpetuated through the generations. Okay. Roast the Korban Pesach only. Don't cook it. Don't eat it partially done. Don't break a bone in it. Don't leave over any for the morning. All part of the mitzvot in perpetuity for Korban Pesach. Wearing your clothes with your belt tied and your shoes on your feet and your bags packed only that first time. So if you look through the Parsha of Shemot, You will find mitzvot and story intertwined, and sometimes it is only the oral law that will help us differentiate between what is part of the mitzvah in all generations and what was anecdotal about that first Pesach Mitzrayim. Apologies once again for keeping this on the short side. I have other things that compete for my time on Thursday, and I try to make more time for the show, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I want to finish with a track from Avi Barak Pesach Seder, based all on Shlomo Kalbach melodies. Therefore, you won't hear the traditional Dayenu melody, but you will hear the song put to a Kalbach tune. And we'll have more time, Emir Tzashem, to talk more along the lines that we started. I want to finish with what I feel is a very strong message, and that Pesach is only the beginning. Yetziat Mitzrayim was the beginning. It's not an end in and of itself. If, Lahavdil, the Emancipation Proclamation that ended slavery for black slaves in the United States in the mid-1800s was the goal, then it's different, because we have a God-given plan right up front. I've said it many times in the last couple of shows. God took us out of Egypt in order to give us the Torah and to bring us to the land of Israel to live a life of Torah. Whatever complicated that process is our fault, but that was the ideal plan. And you see it if you follow through the whole Song of Dayenu, not necessarily just what you will hear in the music, but if you look in Dayenu in the Haggadah, you will see that it goes from Yetziat Mitzrayim to the Midbar, to Matan Torah, to the Shabbat, to Matan Torah, to coming into Eretz Yisrael and the building of the Beit HaMikdash. And therefore, then and only then is the Geula process completed. So until that time, we celebrate and we enjoy, but we also long for more. We say thank you to God for what we have, and please, God, carry us through to the Geula Shlema and a totally new era of life.
Yonu mi mitrayim lo sovohem shefotim ilu sovohem shefotim lo yosov lo keye dai 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 dayeinu dai dai dayeinu dai 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 dayeinu dai dai dayeinu ilu sov lo keye Eloi horag bechoyreyem, ilu horag bechoyreyem, lo nosalonu es momoinom. Dai 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 eleinu, dai 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 eleinu, dai 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 eleinu, dai 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 eleinu. Ilu nosalonu es momoinom, velo korralonu es hayom. Koralonu es hayom velo evironu besoicha bechorovo. Dai 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 eleinu, dai 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 eleinu, dai 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 eleinu, dai 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 eleinu. Ilu evironu besoicha bechorovo velo shikatzoreinu besoichoi. Ilu shikatzoreinu besoichoi. ברחוב רוזי פקסוכין ומתבור ארבו עם שונו די 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 דיינו די די דיינו די 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 דיינו די די דיינו די בקסוכינו במדבור ארבעים שונו ולא החילונו את המון אילו החילונו את המון ולא נוסלונו את השבוס די 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 דיינו די די דיינו די 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 דיינו די די דיינו אילו נוסן לא הורו את השבוס ולא קרבונו לפני הר סיני אילו קרבונו לפני הר סיני ולא נוסן לא נו את התוירו די 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 דיינו די די דיינו די 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 דיינו די די דיינו נוסן לנו את התוירו ולא הכניסונו לארץ ישראל אילו הכניסונו לארץ ישראל ולא בונו לנו בויס הבחירות די 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 דיינו די די דיינו די 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 דיינו די די דיינו
Shabbat Shalom, Lehish Tameah.